And now, City Slickers with Chuck and Victoria. Two judgmental New Yorkers talking movies.
All right, everybody, welcome to City Slickers. I'm Victoria Keelan. I'm here with Chuck Curry, my buddy, my fellow New Yorker. This is our very first episode of City Slickers with Chuck and Victoria. We are so excited to be here. We've been talking about this. How many months has it been now, Chuck?
Many a month, and I feel a 10-year run coming.
I love it. Hey, you know, if you're going to plan something, you might as well plan big, right?
Absolutely.
So yeah, so let's give everybody a little bit of a background of who we are and why we're here and what we're doing together. What is your background, Chuck? Just so I call you my movie guru. So what does that translate to?
You want to know all the facts about my background or just the movie related stuff?
You know, I mean, we can start with your favorite color if you want, but I think maybe stick to the movie.
My favorite color is green, but in general, I've been doing a radio spot on the Doug Steffen radio program for 24 years. And just to give you a little bit of a background, I used to listen to an overnight radio show out of, I believe it was Scranton, Pennsylvania. It was the only overnight radio talk show that's solely based on movies. It was with a host named Larry Katz. So I thought they did a really good job. I was changing the channels on my radio station one night, came across his broadcast. I thought it was very intriguing. I thought the guy was extremely knowledgeable, did a great job. Actually, I became his last caller, and that was the first time I ever called into a radio talk show. I called in, and I wound up being his last caller because the next week his show went defunct after a few year run. I think the station wound up changing formats from basically regular talk radio to a music-oriented standpoint. But I really dug what the guy was doing, so I went on a business trip with a company that I worked for, and there was a lot of different marketing people at this dinner table. It was Sacramento, California, and I wound up speaking to Doug Steffen, who was a radio talk show host, and I pitched him the idea of me wanting to do a radio spot on movies because I had a lot of movie knowledge. I love movies in general. I was somewhat opinionated, and I pitched him the idea. Yeah, so I pitched him the idea of doing this radio spot on his show, having no idea what his reaction would be. We struck up a pretty good conversation. Thought Doug was a good guy. We had a bond. I thought there was electricity in the air. Well, maybe that's going a little bit too far. And what happened is Doug wound up calling me a couple days later. He said, "You know, I gave it some thought, and let's do it." And I wound up going on the air with him. I cultivated a 5-minute-a-day spot. And I'll tell you an interesting story. First day I go on the air, never did this before. Ed McMahon was on the air as a guest with
Doug. Oh, right. And Doug and Ed McMahon were good friends.
And to say my nervous system went into overdrive would be an understatement. So the first few months, I sort of went by a format. And then once I got my footing, I sort of branched into what I wanted to do in terms of being more diverse, going from box office totals to general movie news, or just talk about different things in the industry's trends, what I like to see, what was happening. And
yeah.
It's hard to believe, but 24 years later, I'm still doing it, and that's how I found the connection with you and how we sort of brainstormed doing this idea of a podcast, which I'm very excited to be doing.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You and I both, Doug Steffen is our connector, and I joined Doug's morning show. It's called On Air with Doug, Jen, and Victoria, the DJV show, and I joined that about a year and a half ago. So when it's the first time I heard you and I heard the accent from Brooklyn, I was like, yes, that's my guy. that guy, we need to be doing something together. It took us a little while, but we're finally here and we're finally launching City Slickers, which of course is kind of a double entendre. You and I both talked about liking the movie City Slickers.
I love the movie. If you're a Billy Crystal fan, you know, there's When Harry Met Sally, but for me, City Slickers, which came out in 1989, I think it's an absolutely perfect movie. So I'm very proud to be using that title.
You and I both are New Yorkers. We are City Slickers. So We'll be sharing our opinions, our movie news. I mean, the whole point of doing the City Slickers podcast is to give you a little bit of a slice of New York sarcasm. You and I both love movie history and the history of film. The history of New York City is something that we both really love. And so there's so much culture and iconic films that have been filmed in New York City, and we will eventually, we'll hopefully get to all of them over the next 10 years that we'll be doing this together. So now that we know who we are, let's move on. Let's get into, we've got some movie news, and Chuck is our movie guru. So what's going on? What's the latest with the movie news in Hollywood? We've got some Hollywood gossip that we'll give you every episode. We also will be giving our personal reviews. Chuck has decided to review things from rated on a scale of 1 to 5 zombies. I will be rating on a scale of 1 to 5 glasses of wine. So that will be a little bit later on. We're also going to touch on our favorite Halloween movies, since it's that time of year again, and you and I both love Halloween.
A great time of year, absolutely. I love October. I love Halloween films. I love horror for the most part. And let's get going. Here's some movie news of interest that will bounce off if you give me your opinion. Warner Brothers came out with the running time of Justice League, the new incarnation, which is going to team Batman, Superman, Flash, Wonder Woman, all in one feature film. It's going to be 2 hours, which is going to be the shortest movie in the DC universe. They've had Man of Steel with Henry Cavill, Batman v Superman, which was 2 hours and 45 minutes, and then Suicide Squad, a movie that, another one of their films, which met with a somewhat mixed reaction. I think the running time on that was 2.5 hours. Wonder Woman was a complete home run this summer. Running time on that, I believe, was over 2.5 hours. So Justice League is going to come in at 2 hours running time, which I think is probably good news for theater owners. Certainly you're going to get more show times for that. If you look at the advertising campaign so far, heavy emphasis on Wonder Woman and Batman. No sign of Henry Cavill's Superman yet, at least in the marketing. But clearly, from all accounts, there's no doubt it's a fact. He plays a prominent role in this movie. And I got to ask you a question, because Superman, a lot of people are so ingrained in the Christopher Reeve incarnation of Superman, myself included. I think the 78 version directed by Richard Donner is easily one of the best superhero movies ever made. I think it's a masterpiece, followed by Superman 2, the Richard Lester version, which came out a few years later. In a lot of respects, plays like one long movie. But Christopher Reeve was a great, great
Superman.
He was great. I think the tone of those films was very much different in a different era, where Superman was basically all-American, big-hearted, a much lighter universe. And I think what they did with Henry Cavill's Superman is inject him into a much darker realm, and certainly to make Batman a viable character in Batman v Superman, I think they had to make that universe much darker, which led the Superman character be a little bit darker in tone, which a lot of fans had a mixed feeling about. But what's your opinion of Henry Cavill as Superman Clark Kent as a whole?
Well, the girl answer is he's hot, so that works. But the first, when I did see the first Superman that he was in, Man of Steel, I know a lot of my friends saw it, and they were kind of like, eh, it was okay. He was good, but the movie was kind of eh. And I could see that. I thought it was a little preposterous, Lois Lane up in space, and I thought that was a little too much. But I thought Amy Adams, and I hate to say this, but I thought Amy Adams just looked awkward with him. And I think, and even though they don't have much of an age difference, to me, she just looked and seemed a lot older than he did.
She is older, though. She is old. I think she's 5 years older.
But see, 5 years shouldn't make a difference. Like,
no.
She played like she was 15 years older. Like, there's something, and I like Amy Adams, but there was something just that kind of didn't click there for me. I wish it was a different Lois Lane. But I did really like, I thought he carried the movie really well. When we go to the next step, when it was Batman versus Superman, I thought that was like the most preposterous thing that I've ever even heard of. I was just like, wait, what? Why are, in what universe do they exist together? And I don't really know the answer, but I did like the movie. It actually worked. So I don't know if that was a comic where they were originally together. Do you know the backstory of that?
Yeah, I mean, it was a infamous comic written by Frank Miller. that was very well received, and most of the components from that comic were injected into the storyline of Batman v Superman. You know, that's one of those movies that sort of perplexes me in the fact that I feel like I saw something different than a lot of people seen. It's a very polarizing film, Batman v Superman. The theatrical cut was 2 hours and 45 minutes. Zack Snyder unleashed a Blu-ray cut of 3 hours, which fleshed, well, the theatrical cut, excuse me, was 2.5 hours. The Blu-ray cut under Zack Snyder's direction was 3 hours, which fleshes out a lot of the Clark Kent storyline, and it really humanizes a character a lot better. I like the theatrical cut actually a lot, and I really love the 3 hour cut, which is currently on Blu-ray and streaming. So I saw something in that film that I liked a lot, and I still stand by the point that I fully believe that Batman v Superman in 10 to 15 years is going to have an immense cult following, simply because it will be the darkest we ever see Batman on film. From all accounts, the Bruce Wayne Batman character in Justice League is going to be lightened up substantially, which I had mixed feelings about. I am looking forward to see Henry Cavill's Superman return in that film, and hopefully we get a little bit of a Superman that is a little bit closer in tone than what Christopher Reeve did. Now, having said that, I accept what Zack Snyder did, docking up Superman around the edges. I think for the most part it worked. I'm a big fan of the Man of Steel, except for that one fight scene toward the end, which I think goes on way too long.
Yes, that was long.
I think they just made it that long because it's easy and accessible to be sold to overseas markets. I think the China market likes action, and they gave him action on steroids with that scene. Yeah. But I think Justice League is a very important film in the overall DC Warner Brothers canon, because Wonder Woman was so good and so well received that I think it's important that Justice League be a good movie.
Let's
keep our fingers crossed on that.
And I think that they were so smart with Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman was so incredible. I was just obsessed with it. I've seen it 3 times. I love it. And that's making me, she is making me want to see Justice League now. I also am a big fan of The Flash, the TV show. So even though it's not the same actor, which is a shame because I do think they should have given Grant Gust a chance, but you know, whatever. They never seem to cross over TV with movies. But if it's a 2 hours, I think that's going to be good. Maybe that's going to be like the platform to spin all of those characters off into their next, you know, solo thing. So I think that'll be cool.
And so they just wrapped up filming on Aquaman. Again, Aquaman, I forgot to mention, is also in Justice League. And then sometime next year, it looks like they're going to go into production on Wonder Woman 2 under the same direction of Patty Jenkins, who I think did an amazing job on the original film. I mean, we could talk about Gal Gadot, how good she was for the next 2 hours, but she really is... a perfect Princess Diana, Wonder Woman. I think she's got all the intangibles of something very special on screen as an actress. One other bit of movie news of interest, Star Wars The Last Jedi, which opens on December 15th, Christmas time. Pretty nice Christmas gift, tracking at a $215 million opening weekend. It's really interesting when you look back at film, all the franchises we've had over the years, some have really stood the test of time. I mean, you got the James Bond movies, which have gone from the 1960s up into current day. Batman now is an existing universe since 1989. I've spoken many times about the Rocky universe and how amazing it is for a character that started in a 1976 movie as an independent low-budget film about an underdog boxer named Rocky Balboa, still being a franchise now with Sylvester Stallone going to return for Creed 2,
which is so good. Creed was, Creed for 1 second. I mean, if we haven't recommended that already highly enough on our individual social media chains, at Poseidon72 for Chucker and at On Air Victoria for me, that is a movie that surprised me like no other movie has. I had never fully seen any of the Rockies. My husband is constantly watching Rocky. Every time it's on TV, he'll watch it again and again. I never had any interest, but I saw Creed and I'm in. I'm in for, if they want to do another 6, I'm in. I thought it was just phenomenal. And it really struck me what a great actor Sylvester Stallone really is. He was subtle. There was a lot of nuance in it. I just can't say enough things about it. And I thought Who was the guy who played the young Apollo or whatever his name
was? Michael B. Jordan.
He was phenomenal. His girlfriend was incredible. I love that subplot. I thought it was really something for everybody. It was a great movie.
I agree with you. And it was directed by Ryan Coogler, who got the directorial reins of Marvel's The Black Panther and other superhero movies. He's not going to be directing Creed 2. Sylvester Stallone is not only going to direct it.
Oh, good.
But, he wrote the script, so we'll see where that goes. But my point is that Star Wars, of all the franchises over time, nothing radiates and almost has a symbolic religious aspect to the Star Wars mystique. There's just nothing like it. I loved The Force Awakens. I thought that was a terrific
movie
directed by J.J. Abrams, who's going to direct another Star Wars movie.
Is he directing The Last Jedi?
He's not directing The Last Jedi. Ron Howard's directing Han Solo, a Star Wars movie which comes out next summer. But J.J. Abrams is going to direct the next installment in the Star Wars franchise, which I think that's really good news, because I think he's a solid director, knows the material, respects the material, and is just a perfect fit for that material. One other thing.
One other quick thing about the Star Wars movie, The Last Jedi, is on social media, it's now starting to trend. My dad is from Ireland, and all my family is still there. And that island, when you see that first scene of in the Last Jedi, when Mark Hamill as Luke Skywalker is on that little rocky island, that's an island that's off of the southwest coast of Ireland that has now seen such a boom in tourism. And it's an ecological island, which, you know, it kind of looks like a movie set. It doesn't look like it's actually real, you know, but it is. And they only allow, I think, 280 people at one time are allowed on the island because it's a nature preserve. And they have seen such an incredible spike in tourism and people wanting to charter boats because you can only get to it on a charter. And it is unbelievable, like, the global effect of Star Wars. It's even affecting tourism now. And it's kind of like the Harry Potter films, where a lot of them were filmed on the west coast of Ireland too, and people are so rabid for these films and these characters, they just want to go and be where they were shot. And I think it's really cool to move a lot of that stuff off of sound stages onto real locations, because it's a boom for the tourist industry.
I agree with you, and I'm actually glad for Mark Hamill, who's going to basically get back big time in the limelight, being a major presence in this new Star Wars film.
Well, he's had a good turn on The Flash. He's had on The Flash on the CW. That's where I first saw him again after seeing Star Wars. I didn't know where he's been all these years. And
well,
he's
done a lot of voice work and animated stuff. Actually, has been acclaimed as a voice of the Joker in some of the Batman animated stuff that they've done over the last 10 or 15 years. So Mark Hamill has worked, but obviously he's not had the career that other counterparts from the original series.
Well, like a Harrison Ford, I mean, I don't know if Mark Hamill, I don't see why there wouldn't be a reason why he could have had a career like that, but I guess it just didn't go that way. But you're right. I mean, to be resurrected in, you know, one of the most iconic roles really in the history of film is Luke Skywalker. And it's so many generations now. I mean, that first Star Wars was what, late
70s? 1977. Here's another.
So then you've got so many different people.
And here's another point of view, and I'll get your opinion on this, which I find interesting. Somebody pointed out, I was reading on the net, that every villain in a Star Wars movie on the poster was the top of the poster, like Darth Vader. Every poster they did was up top. Darth Maul in the first Lucas prequel was the top of the poster. And the newest poster for The Last Jedi, Mark Hamill's Luke Skywalker, is the top of the poster. So does that mean that Luke Skywalker is going to go to the dark side and be the villain for this latest installment? I think, listen, my gut feeling tells me that's going to be the case. And I think that is going to create, not that these movies need any more buzz, but once that does get out upon the initial release in the opening weekend, that's just going to create more and more buzz for this film. And, it's interesting, you know, because you know marketing, like I know marketing. Does Disney or Lucasfilm even have to spend really one dime marketing a new Star Wars movie. I mean, I know social media is really the forefront of where they spend a lot of marketing dollars these days, but they'll probably still spend $30 million to market the film and TV and radio and so on and so forth. But people are going to go see. I mean, you don't need to spend money to market a Star Wars movie. People know it's coming out, and they're going to line up.
Yeah, that's
to see
true.
It on for the first month.
That's true. And let's get to, we've got one more bit of movie news, and then we're going to get into some Halloween stuff. So the new trailer, which you sent me, The Commuter with Liam Neeson, that looks mind blowing. What do you know about that movie?
It looks really good. It's from the director of Nonstop, which is another Liam Neeson movie that took place on a on an airplane. That same director. His name is, I think, Jean Calat Sierra. Is a Spanish director. Directed the movie The Shallows, which is a nice surprise hit.
That was a good movie. I like that.
Shark movie starring Blake Lively. I like that film a lot. This trailer is really good. Liam Neeson plays an insurance salesman who meets a mysterious passenger played by Vera Farmiga. Many might know her from the George Clooney movie Up in the Air, also the Conjuring movies, and she was the star of A&E's Bates Motel. Tells Liam Neeson in the trailer that there's $75,000 in cash in the bathroom, and you have to find a hidden passenger of interest if you want the money. It's a very compelling trailer. A movie comes out in January. Liam Neeson gave an interview not long ago that this would be his last forte into action, but then a few days later signed on to do another action movie. You know, his career's been really interesting. Because he's a fantastic actor. I mean, he is the guy who starred in Schindler's List, a great actor who really has since taken sort of filled out that Charles Bronson-like mystique into a new generation. He's doing some of the stuff that Charles Bronson did in the 1980s. I mean, as an actor, Liam Neeson's a better actor than Charles Bronson, but Charles Bronson certainly had a really unique, interesting, and I think terrific screen presence back in the day. But I like the stuff Liam Neeson does in action, and I look forward to this movie. It's titled The Commuter, comes out this January. So if people want to see the trailer, go on YouTube. It's actually really well done.
And we'll post it, too, on all of our social media for City Slickers Pod is at City Slickers Pod on Twitter, at City Slickers Pod on Facebook, and same thing with Instagram. And so we'll post that. We'll be periodically posting a lot of movie news and things like that because so much stuff comes up during the week. We want to make sure that we keep you guys informed. So we'll have all of that on our social media. Make sure you check us out at City Slickers Pod. Also on blogtalkradio.com/City Slickers Pod is where you can subscribe to us, and it will magically appear in your feed. You don't even need to do anything. So now, the name City Slickers. Obviously, we're both New Yorkers. You with that fabulous Brooklyn accent of yours that I always talk about.
I haven't noticed, really.
But we've said that we wanted to do...
Don't tell my wife. She doesn't know I have an accent.
We want to dedicate a little bit of time every week to our hometown. And so this week... You have picked a movie moment for us, a New York City movie moment that is perfectly in keeping with Halloween. And of course, over the next few weeks, we're also going to be talking about other different horror genres and things like that. But I think Amityville Horror is the most perfect movie, a New York movie that we could start with from 1979. I love this movie. I had no idea what to expect when I first saw it, but I really, really love it. So what's the backstory on Amityville Horror?
You know, I'll tell you a quick story from my own personal recollection. I don't know what year it was when I was very young, growing up in Brooklyn, New York. There was a newspaper which is still in existence, the Daily News. And on Sunday, the Daily News used to be a really big newspaper, and they had a middle section. And it had to be sometime late in '77 because it was a book originally based on this subject matter that I think was written. Or dictated as a source material by Kathy Lutz, who her and her husband George bought this dream house in Amityville, Long Island, and they didn't know that there was a murder in this house, a shotgun murder a year before. And the story goes in her recollection that there was all sorts of horrific incidents in this house, that it was haunted, and it wound up driving them out of the house on a very scary night. One night during a rainstorm, which is recollected in the feature film, which stars James Brolin and Margaret Kidder. So to make a long story short, sometime before 79, it might have been 79, there was a newspaper article that gave, it was like the whole middle section that basically recounted this story. I think it was to preview the movie. And I remember my father picking up the newspaper, showing it to me, showing me this story about the Amityville Horror. And I read it, and it really stoked me. And I found it very, you know, creepy, because back in the day, before social media and before the innovation of so many cable networks and so much information that's literally rammed down our throat, when you read a story like this, it had more of a psychological effect.
Yeah, I can imagine, yeah.
And then the movie comes out in 1979. Critics were very mixed on it, but audiences showed up in droves. This movie made a lot of money. It was released by an independent called American International Distribution. It was one of the highest grossing independent films of the time. I love the musical score to it. I actually dig the movie. I think it holds up. I think it's a good movie. It's creepy. I actually think Brolin, the lead in this movie, is really good. I think he's a really good actor, currently married to Barbara Streisand. But I thought he did a really good job in his part of George Luntz, guy who basically was going insane living in this house. Margaret Kidder was good as Kathy Lutz. Rod Steiger played the priest. A lot of people have an issue with, if you remember the scene with all those flies in the room.
Oh, yeah.
Movie. Some people like it, some people don't. I think the movie overall is effective, but it took place, the story, in Amityville, Long Island. It has part of a lore in terms of New York City history, in terms of a story. Years later, the story was obviously debunked as being all made up. Although, if you want to take it literally as a story, I think it's effective. In Amityville Horror from 1979, I think it's a pretty good movie.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I think it's entertaining. I mean, was I the only one who was nervous the dog wasn't, that they were going to leave the dog behind? I'm such an animal lover at the end.
I love that scene. I love that. If I called him Josh, he's James Brolin. I love that scene during the rainstorm.
Yep.
When they get in the car, get the two kids, let's get the heck out of this house. They drive down the block, and all of a sudden, James Brolin hits the brakes, stops short. I got to go back, goes back in the house. If you remember, he's going down the stairs. All that tar is leaking down the stairs, picks up the dog, gets out of the house. I mean, I have to assume back in the day in that year, people watching that in the theater, people had to be on the edge of the seat, because when you involve a dog emotionally, it really gets to you. And
that's
I thought that scene worked. And you know, it's whether it's a made up story or not, it works as a film. And it's a creepy story. It's basically a standard haunted house movie, but good cast. New York related, and I liked it.
And you know, and the true part of that is that there were, in 1974, there were a series of murders in the house. A 23-year-old son, Ronald DeFeo Jr. was his name, shot and killed his parents and his four siblings as they were asleep. So that part of it was true. The haunting.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you look at they did numerous sequels, and part two is a prequel. That's what that part two is about. It's about that actual family and the real murder.
Yeah.
Burt Young, who played Paulie in the Rocky movies, played the father in that prequel, which came out a few years after.
Well, I would definitely add that one too. I think it's a classic horror movie. I think it's really good suspense. There's not too much gore, because I'm not really a fan of the gore, but I think it holds up. I think it's a great movie. And again, talking about tourism, like from The Last Jedi, that house, which is the address they say is 108 Ocean Avenue in Amityville, Long Island, that house has more people driving up to it because it's right on the street. It's an old Dutch colonial, and people take pictures in front of it all the time, and numerous times it's been sold. And I think it was even just last year was on the market again for like $580,000. And people don't want to live there because so many people know about it in New York and Long Island, and they want to, you know, kids show up on Halloween, and it's a whole big thing. So it's interesting how it's kind of negatively affected the real estate value of the actual house, let alone why would you want to live in a murder house anyway? But
exactly. I think that more than the value of what I pay, buy or sell for it, I just don't think I'd want to live there.
All right, so now let's get into some of our favorite Halloween movies. You and I have been talking back and forth and texting each other of which movies we like and what we think holds up for Halloween. And it's not necessarily movies about Halloween that we decided we would use. We're each going to have a top five, but we kind of decided let's do a mix of movies that are Halloween themed maybe and a mix of movies that we really like watching at this time of year. So, Chucker, I think you should go first with your list. I'm anxious to hear what you landed on for your top five. Let's go 5-1.
5-1, I'm going to go with I went with Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1978, directed by Philip Kaufman. I love this movie. I think this is one of the best films of the 1970s. Great cast, Donald Sutherland, Brooke Adams, who was very appealing, co-starred The Dead Zone with Christopher Walken back in 1980. Jeff Goldblum's in this movie, Leonard Nimoy. And while this movie's been done at least a handful of times, it was done in 56 with Kenneth Moore. Another version that I like, it was done in 1993, a movie called Body Snatchers, directed by Abel Ferrara, starring an actress named Gabriel Anwar. I like that version, and I really like the 2005 version with Nicole Kidman, simply titled Invasion. Critics were not kind to that film, but I don't know what it is about the concept, but I like it. And basically,
Is it about? Give us a quick, because I've never seen it. I don't know anything about it. So what's the synopsis?
In this version, Donald Sutherland plays a health inspector, mm-hmm. and slowly finds out that people are being replaced by alien pods and their bodies being duplicated. And as the movie goes on, it gains more and more of a sense of dread. This is a downbeat film. It's not an upbeat film. But of all the versions of this story, to me, this one resonates the most powerfully. I think it's beautifully directed. I think the acting is top-notch. And what's interesting, actors like Donald Sutherland, who were terrific actors, were able to lead films in 1978. It's unlikely you'd see an actor like Donald Sutherland, especially since he's not the classic good-looking leading man, leading a movie now into 2017. I mean, if they redone this movie again, which again, I think Warner Brothers is contemplating yet another remake, you'll probably get an actor like a Brad Pitt or somebody of a different...
More like a leading man type.
No, more of a leading man type. And yeah. I think Donald Sutherland was a terrific character actor that did very well as a leading man. But this movie just has a really solid sense of dread. It's very well acted. The storyline is fascinating. And it's so topical because it's just interesting how people's personas, the way you look at people, their thought process, the way you judge them. And in this film, the people that they know, people that they interact with, are changing on a daily basis. And the more the movie goes on, the more they realize there's something bigger going on. And their ability to change this outcome is really something that they can't control. So it is a downbeat movie, but it is very powerful. And there's one really cool sequence that's really well scored where Jeff Goldblum's character breaks off from the group so the others can get away. I love that sequence. It takes place, this version, in San Francisco. Kenneth Moore, who starred in the original film, does a cameo in the beginning of the movie. And there's also some really unique cameo by Robert Duvall, who plays a priest, basically swinging on a swing in the beginning of the movie. He has no speaking lines. He's just there. But this is one of my favorite films of the 70s. I love it as a horror film. And it's one of those movies I always watch at Halloween time. So that is my number five, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Number four, I went with The Shining, and I'll tell you why. The Shining is a movie that I never saw in a movie theater until a few years ago, and I'm associated with an independent movie house, an art house film theater that I'm the CFO, and I'm on the board of directors, and I do a lot of programming for it in East Stroudsburg. It's called Pocono Cinema. So I've done 150 revival showings of classic films over the last 5 years. So we booked The Shining. It's been a long time since I've seen it. And I sit down and I watch it. And I got to tell you, you have not seen The Shining, Victoria, until you've seen it in a movie theater.
I could see that, yeah.
Claustrophobic, hypnotic experience directed by one of the most interesting directors who ever got behind a camera, and that's Stanley Kubrick. It's very well-known fact that Stephen King had issues with this film version because Kubrick takes a lot of liberties with the story. It's no doubt that Jack Torrance, the character played by Jack Nicholson, goes bonkers very quickly into the film, very different that was in the novel. But in terms of atmosphere, in terms of spookiness, just isolationism, whatever you want to call it, this movie really captures that feel. And I think it is, and I use this term rarely, but I think The Shining, seen in a theater, I would regard it as a masterpiece. I love the casting of Shelley Duvall, a very unorthodox actress, but I think her chemistry in this film with Jack Nicholson is really unique. And it's no secret that Kubrick was a very controlling type genius director who was hard on his actors, and he'd have the actors like Nicholson do one take in each scene 40, 50 times, a simple take over and over and over again.
I've heard that about him,
And Shelley Duvall, you know, many years after the fact, said it was in a grueling shoot. But and then one other fact that people may not know about this film, that the Overlook Hotel, the setting of this movie, was actually shot on sound stages in England. So they recreated the look of a hotel, which is incredible. And it was one of the first uses of a process called Steadicam. And there's a shot in the film that has to be seen in a theater setting where Danny, the little boy, is riding a big wheel tricycle around the hallways. And he goes from a carpeted square multicolored rug to wood, and the sound would go on a rug silent to on the wood. You hear this wheel.
Yes, that's right. And I remember that. Yeah.
And when you see the camera on the big screen in the tricycle scene, it is a fascinating, beautifully shot movie. So I love The Shining. That's my number four. Number three, I actually went with Halloween 2 from 1981. I love the original film by Carpenter in 78, and Halloween 2 makes it feel like 1 4-hour movie, or actually 3-hour movie, 90 minutes apiece. But I just, something about Halloween 2 I like watching on Halloween, directed by Rick Rosenthal, who I think did a really good job, although Carpenter came in and did some of the reshoots to make the movie a little bit more graphic, to get in tone with the violence that was set by Friday the 13th that came out in 1980. If you remember, in 78, Halloween, the original film, really was a bloodless movie.
Mm-hmm.
Very well shot, suspenseful. The cinematography was incredible, but it really has no blood. Most of the violence is implied. Halloween 2, the violence is right there. The bathtub, the hot tub sequence, Carpenter went and put that sequence in. The hammer sequence to the security guard's head, and then there's a needle sequence through a doctor's eye in the movie, all injected by Carpenter to basically be in touch with the new slasher-like mentality set after Friday the 13th in 1980. But I really dig Halloween 2, and the sequence in the hospital when Michael Myers breaks through that glass doorway to come after Laurie Strode and Dr. Loomis. I just dig it, so I put that as my number three. Now, number two, a movie that I love and I consider a masterpiece, and that's George Romero's 1978 movie, Dawn of the Dead. Now, in New York City, Victoria, in the late 70s, early 80s, there were two movies that always played at midnight. One was the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which still plays to this day. Mm-hmm. And the other movie that played at midnight was George Romero's Dawn of the Dead, his sequel to the 68 classic Night of the Living Dead. This one is more epic in scope. They shot it at the Monroeville Mall in Monroeville, Pennsylvania. George Romero had a friend who controlled the mall, and they shot most of the sequences from midnight to 7 in the morning, off hours. And this movie has tremendous social commentary, great atmosphere. Ken Forte makes, I think, for a great hero. It's a complex movie that I think is unique, considering the fact they shot it for less than $1 million. It feels so much more in terms of scope. But for people who haven't seen George Romero's Dawn of the Dead, I didn't see it in a theater. I just saw it on VHS at the time, but I did a private screening at our theater last year. I think it holds up incredibly well. The original trilogy of Romero, which is Night of the Living Dead, 68, Dawn of the Dead, 78, and then you had Day of the Dead from the 1990s. I love that original trilogy, but Dawn of the Dead, to me, is the best zombie movie ever made, so I put that as my number two.
So also in upcoming episodes, we're going to be talking more about different niches of horror flicks, and when we get to zombies, that's your forte. I'm assuming Dawn of the Dead will make it into your top five as well.
No doubt about that. See, now I'll go to my number one, which for me is a no-brainer. This is not only my favorite horror movie of all time, but it's also one of my all-time top favorite movies of all time, and I think one of the best movies ever made, and that's The Exorcist from 1973, which in a lot of ways, Victoria, was more than just a feature film. It was a cultural event, and if you look at this stat, which is amazing, 110 million people paid to see The Exorcist in the United States and Canada.
Wow.
Back in 1973. People literally lined up around city blocks in New York City, literally around the block, waiting to get in to see this movie. People passed out. People were shocked. People fainted. I know this sounds somewhat hyperbole to say that in 2017, that any movie could have this effect on the conscience of the American public, but the Exorcist did. And what makes it so amazing is that it's a hard R movie. But the reason this movie works both as a great movie and also a horror film is it never really feels like a horror movie. It just feels like a real movie, real life events. The stakes are very high. Basically, about a woman, a working actress in the movie, played by Ellen Burstyn, a terrific actress, whose daughter may or may not be possessed by Satan himself. The daughter, played by Linda Blair, who is 12 years old at that time, does an amazing job in this movie. The makeup effects are incredible. Director William Friedkin pulls no punches whatsoever with the graphic tone and violence. The violence is not only graphic visually, but psychologically. I don't think there's ever been a movie more disturbing unleashed on the American public than The Exorcist. I simply love the performance of Jason Miller as Father Karras, one of my favorite all-time characters in a movie. And I think it's interesting that the place and time when it was set, the country was at a very turbulent time back in 1973, actually in the early 70s, you're dealing with the Vietnam War. And then a year before, you had a movie which is my favorite film of all time, The Poseidon Adventure, dealing with a priest who is in crisis. And you get the same thing here in The Exorcist a year later, to Jason Miller character playing a priest in crisis who's losing his faith. And I think his characterization in the movie is the heart of the film, and the ending of that movie where he's pounding on the possessed girl for the soul, her soul, to jump into him. It's just an incredible scene, but this is a masterpiece of a film. I think it holds up today, and I think it's the best horror movie ever made. And like I said, I still believe The Exorcist is one of the best movies ever released, so that's my number one. So number five, Invasion. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go. Give us a recap.
Yeah, number five, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the 78 version directed by Philip Kaufman. Number four, The Shining, directed by Stanley Kubrick. Number three, I went with Halloween 2. Number two, George Romero's masterwork, Dawn of the Dead from 78. And number one, William Friedkin's The Exorcist, Jason Miller, Ellen Burstyn. A great film.
It is, and I have always traditionally been very afraid of scary movies, and everyone sort of makes fun of me for it, but I recently, within the last year and a half or so, saw The Exorcist, and I loved it, and I thought it was an amazing psychological thriller. I thought it had a lot of heart to it. I thought it was heartbreaking at times. I thought the going after, you know, the Catholic Church the way that it does, I thought that was really controversial, and then, like you said, when you look at the time frame that it actually came out, that was kind of crazy. To me, the most shocking thing beyond the horror or the violence or any of the psychological aspect, I can't believe that American audiences were able to tolerate a 12-year-old girl saying the very perverse and sexual things that she says in that movie. I mean, my jaw dropped at that. That's really what shocked me the most in 2016 when I saw it. That I was like, oh my God. I mean, it would be kind of surprising to see a little kid saying things like that now. But back then, I can't even imagine the shock value that it must have had. I mean, it offended everybody, I guess.
I mean, and you bring up a really good point, because when you look at how many people went to see this movie, clearly it expanded 100-fold from just a standard core horror type audience. You got, the majority of the general public went to see this film in a movie theater back in 1973. Clearly hit some sort of a nerve. I mean, it's a different era. Social media was non-existent, but for whatever reason, in the consciousness of the American public, people knew that this movie existed, that it was extremely well received, that it was shocking, so on and so forth. And but they showed up in droves to see The Exorcist in a movie theater, and I think well rewarded. Again, it's simply a great movie.
And also, speaking to that exact point, you sent me some incredible footage of audience reactions from seeing The Exorcist, and you weren't joking. I mean, the lines went around city blocks. They had police involved, you know, getting people, roping them, snaking them in and out of a line. They had ushers talking about holding smelling salts because so many people were fainting. It was a cultural phenomenon. So we're definitely going, I'm going to make sure we post that video of the audience reactions to The Exorcist. It is super cool. So make sure you give us a follow on at City Slickers Pod on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. It's all the same, at City Slickers Pod. So we'll wrap up our episode one here with my top five Halloween movies. They're not all traditional scary movies, but they are five movies that I do like to watch as soon as Halloween, as soon as there's a chill in the air and a pumpkin is in a patch, I need to start watching some of these movies. So number five, I don't know how you feel about this. I don't think we've ever talked about this movie, The Witches of Eastwick. I love this movie. I love the cast. It's Cher and Susan Sarandon and Michelle Pfeiffer and Jack Nicholson. I love witches in general. It's set in a quintessential New England town. I've actually been to the church where they filmed it. It's in a town called Chatham. Is it Chatham? No, Hingham. It's in Hingham, Massachusetts. It's a beautiful old colonial New England town. And it is, to me, this movie never gets old. I think it's creepy, but it's also funny at times. And I just think that, I don't know, as soon as I love witches, like I said, so as soon as I want to start watching something with witches, I always end up going back to Eastwick. Are you a fan of this movie, or what are your thoughts on it?
I like it. If you take... this is clearly one of Jack Nicholson's signature roles. If you take out, besides The Cuckoo's Nest, Batman, The Shining, and A Few Good Men, this would probably be his top five signature role in film. It's been a vast career, but the star power is off the charts in this movie. Nicholson, Cher, Pfeiffer, Susan Sarandon. It was very well received and a big box office hit in its day.
Yeah, it's cool. So number four is our only crossover between both of our lists. I went with Halloween 2. I loved Halloween 1 and 2. I watched them back to back, which did, like you said, made me feel like it was one long movie, which I really liked. Halloween 1 felt like a prequel. It does a nice job of setting up Halloween 2. But for me, Halloween 2 is when all the action starts, and it's not too much violence, but it's a good amount of suspense. I love Jamie Lee Curtis, and I just thought that the way the story continued in Halloween 2, I think it's kind of like a perfect horror movie. So if you haven't seen any of the Halloween franchises, I don't even know how many they've made now, right? I mean, it must just be, is it Halloween 6 or Halloween 7? They keep bringing them back. I think Jamie Lee Curtis is coming.
I think it's 9 or 10. Halloween 1, 2, like one continuation. Halloween 3, they went into the anthology realm where Michael Myers did not return, although they used it.
Right, he's not in that one, right.
Didn't make a lot of money, although over time people have regarded that film as pretty good. It stars an actor named Tom Atkins. I like it. They're going to make...
She's back, I think you told me, right?
Right, she's coming back. From what I read, though, it might be a direct continuation of revisionist history. They're going to ignore everything that came after the first film. So as much as we like Halloween 2, we might have to take our Blu-ray and throw it in the garbage pail.
Well, my number three is there's no violence at all, but it is a true suspense thriller. I remember I watched this in the movie theater with my mom. We went on a girl date, and both of us were like kind of grabbing the armchair thing, and we were just like, this is so intense. It's called The Others, starring Nicole Kidman. Really, no one else recognizable in the cast, at least to me, but I thought that this was just such a classic horror thriller suspense movie. It's to me the most unique, and I'm not going to give it away in case people haven't seen it yet, but to me it was the most unique spin of a ghost story that I've ever seen in a movie.
I agree with you. It's a really good movie. This is another film that was well received. Nicole Kidman does a really good job as the lead in the film. She for the most part always does good work. This movie was a hit, and it's really good, and it holds up.
And see, it's funny you say it was a hit, because like I feel like I don't really know many people who've seen it. So I'm not sure if maybe I just was really, I missed the boat, or my group of friends missed
the boat on that one.
I guess
so. You and your friends missed the boat. It made some coin in theaters.
Good. Well, number two, another Nicole Kidman starring vehicle. This one, all of my friends have seen. We are all obsessed. We watch it as soon as like late September hits, all the way pretty much through the end of the year. Practical Magic. This is Sandra Bullock and such an amazing cast. Nicole Kidman, Sandra Bullock, Stockard Channing, Diane Wiest. It's just, if you like witches and you like that New England vibe to it, I think it's just a perfect kind of movie. Aidan Quinn is also phenomenal in it, and I could watch this movie over and over and over. I often do, and I never get sick of it.
I can't tell you I watch it over and over, but I'm sure the marketing campaign went something like this. For people who loved Hocus Pocus, you got yourself some practical magic.
That could be true. It is girly. I'll give you that. It's girly, okay. But hey, it's good. And my number one movie that I have to watch every Halloween is Sleepy Hollow, the version starring Johnny Depp. It's a Tim Burton film. Johnny Depp, Christina Ricci, an unbelievable cast. If you liked Tim Burton films, you'll see a lot of actors that you'll recognize. And to me, there's nothing more Halloween than the Headless Horseman. Christopher Walken is the best villain in most of the movies he's in. He's great in this. I get the goosebumps from it. It's another New York film. I mean, I've been to actual Sleepy Hollow. I don't know if you've been, but I've been to the graveyard where Washington Irving was buried, and where he sat and basically sat in that little Dutch colonial church where the movie pretty much takes place towards the end. And the actual covered bridge, which isn't actually a covered bridge in real life, but it is a bridge where he imagined the Headless Horseman charging in towards the church. And it's really an incredible day trip if you're in the tri-state area in the fall, the foliage, everything. That's my tourism recommendation, as well as a movie recommendation. That is my number one. So my 5-1 best Halloween movies: Witches of Eastwick, number 5, Halloween 2, Chucker and I both shared that one on our list, number 4, number 3, The Others. It's a suspense thriller with Nicole Kidman. Number 2, Practical Magic, one of my favorite movies ever. And number 1, Sleepy Hollow.
It's a good pick. I like that movie actually a lot. And it's interesting because Tim Burton, the latter half of his career, has been really up and down. That one's one of the ups, and I agree with you. Depp's really good. Christina Ricci, who I like a lot. I think she's a very appealing talent. And Christopher Walken, always good. Good pick. I like that film.
Good. Well, happy Halloween, everybody. This is episode 1 of City Slickers with Chuck and Victoria. Make sure you give us a follow on City Slickers Pod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And you can subscribe to City Slickers at blogtalkradio.com/CitySlickersPod. And make sure you follow Chucker at Poseidon72. You can follow all of his movie mania on Twitter. And you can follow me as well, On Air Victoria. Don't forget, hit subscribe and make sure that you follow City Slickers. And we will be back in another week. Thanks a lot, Chucker. We'll talk to you guys soon.
You got it. Had a lot of fun.